Hey guys, and welcome to Hunting Land, presented by Great Days Outdoors Magazine. If you'd like to stay up to date on hunting tactics, land management, land values, and land market dynamics, this is the podcast for you. This week's show is brought to you by LS Tractor. LS Tractor is known for building top quality, high value tractors. Headquartered in Brattleboro, North Carolina, they specialize in tractors ranging from 22 to 101 horsepower. LS Tractor offers a full line of subcompact, compact, and utility tractors, as well as a growing list of implements and attachments. LS Tractor is committed to providing personal customer service and quality products through an exceptional dealer network throughout the U.S. and Canada. For more information on LS Tractor or LS Tractor products, please visit lstractorusa.com. Start blue, stay blue. NCX. As a landowner, the more income I can generate from my land, the better I can take care of it. That's why I use NCX. NCX helps over 20,000 American landowners like you understand and maximize the value of every acre. Find new revenue streams for your land with programs like timber, carbon, wildlife habitat, solar energy, and more. Get started with a free account at ncx.com and discover the true value of your land. I'm your host, Joe Baia, here today with Nick Williams and Butch Theory. Guys, today we're going to be talking about something that's serious. I've definitely experienced this in my lifetime, and I hope other people don't have to, but I also hope that they're just prepared if they do, and that is experiencing an emergency in the outdoors. It happens fast. I can tell you that from multiple experiences that I've had. You're not going to have time to think about what you need to do at that time. You are going to need to be prepared before it happens. Hopefully have gone through all the steps that it takes to handle emergency correctly, because adrenaline is super high and you get tunnel vision, man. It's a scary environment. You definitely need to plan and prepare. Nick, do you guys have a plan when you go back into the Mobile Tensaw River Swamp? Almost 200,000 acres of probably about as remote as it gets, east of the Mississippi. Y'all got a plan for what you're going to do if you ever encounter a problem?
We kind of had the iron one out last year. I've always played it pretty fast and loose. But yeah, when Sarah was pregnant, and now especially since we have our little baby, yes, we have firmed up a rough outline for an emergency plan for sure.
Butch, you know, whenever you have them little ones, it's a lot more to think about than just your old dumb self. You got to worry about leaving them behind and leaving mama to deal with everything that you left behind. If you know, something like this were to happen to you and you didn't have a great plan in place, or at least, you know, a series of things to fall back on: communication, signaling devices, satellite communication, anything of the above. A couple of things that you can do in order to definitely lessen the impact of something like this if it were to ever happen to you.
Butch, when we were growing up, going offshore a lot, you know, your family's in the charter business. I was down there working with you. We always had a good plan, good solid plan. Coast Guard's watching real closely what you're doing, especially when you're taking people for hire, you know, going 120 miles offshore. You had those thoughts and you went through those and we drilled it and we were ready. Mm-hmm. I always felt like we were ready anyway. It's still scary though. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, those situations. And what about on your land? Have you and your family talked about what y'all are going to do up there? You know, if you were to have a problem, just, you know, it's not crazy remote, but it's still probably, you're probably a good 45 minutes from some type of emergency care, I would think, right there.
Yep. Yeah, we have definitely, you know, over the years compiled together a sheet of close medical facilities and, you know, the best routes possible. And yeah, a little emergency action plan is definitely a must, especially, you know, when you're an hour away from most things.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're a hunter or an angler, you almost undoubtedly spend time in environments where this is important. We got a really awesome guest today. We're talking with Wes Madden. He's a former medevac pilot, spent a lot of time in Alaska. You know, talk about remote. He was dealing with it constantly up there. We're going to be learning from some of his experiences about what you need to be thinking about on your land, out on the water, no matter where you hunt or fish, everything you need to go through so that you're ready if this happens to you. Wes, thanks for joining us today. This is an important topic. I hope we can create some kind of clickbaity title, you know, headline for this that gets a lot of people to listen to this podcast, because I've been involved in a couple of emergencies in the outdoors, and you don't have time to figure this stuff out when the emergency is happening. You need to plan for it ahead of time. Planning for anything is not that sexy of a topic. You know, it's not something a lot of people want to really think about, safety and all that kind of stuff, but it's scary out there when this kind of stuff happens. If you can fall back on your training, you're going to do a lot better than if you don't. That being said, tell us a little bit about your experience. You've got some really cool background in dealing with outdoor emergencies with folks.
Well, thank you for having me on the podcast. Big fan of the show.
Thanks.
Yeah, this is one of those topics that I'm sure folks would see and they go, who needs to be... We need to prepare for emergencies. Let's go on to the more exciting topics. But yeah, I was fortunate. I got commissioned into the Army. I took an Army ROTC scholarship when my wrestling career dwindled my freshman year of college, and I had to pay for school. So the Army pays for you to go to school, and I graduated no debt. Was able to get commissioned as a second lieutenant, and I put in for flight school and specifically aeromedical evacuation. And the reason I did that was I get to fly around and help people, as opposed to, although the guns would have been fun, but, I wanted to be able to, actually do something, that I felt would be rewarding and adding significance in the world. And it's just such a cool, my dad was a Vietnam veteran, and he talked about these dust off pilots and how they just like come in under fire and get their guys out. And I was like, man, just so heroic. And it was something that I think the lineage from Vietnam on, really, really took hold. And so anyways, was able to get assigned. My first duty station was Alaska. And as a fellow outdoorsman, I'm a fishing nut, hunting nut. And to get that assignment, and by the way, it's the best flying in the world, because there's a lot of it's uncontrolled airspace. I mean, literally, we spent most of our training flights spotting moose, caribou, bears, wolves. So we were really successful when moose season came around because we knew where they all were. But the cool thing about my time in Alaska, so I was with the 68th Medical Company out of Fort Wainwright, which is in Fairbanks, right in the middle of the state. And Alaska's very rural. I mean, when I was there was a little over 600,000 people in a state that's 2.5 times the size of Texas. So the Army had an agreement after Vietnam. So going back to Vietnam, where we had all these helicopter pilots trained, they actually started a program. Congress authorized the use of military helicopters be used when there wasn't a civilian provider to provide aeromedical evacuation. It was called Military Assistance to Safety and Traffic, otherwise known as MAST. So we were the last unit that had a real world mission with the MAST mission. And basically, if you drew a 500 nautical mile circle around Fairbanks and you got sick, hurt, lost, if we knew about it, a lot of times people would call the state troopers, right? And the state troopers would take that 911 call and they say, hey, the husband went out hunting and didn't come back, the troopers would ask, well, where do you think he went? He was running trap lines and he went out this way and he always goes down this trail. So we can kind of figure out through the troopers and talking to the whoever was calling in the rescue. And then he'd go to the rescue coordination center down at Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson. And then we'd get the call and it'd be in the form of a 9-line medevac request. And that's when we'd launch. So we pulled 24-hour first up duty. We had the helicopter pre-flighted and ready to go. We could be pulling pitch in 5 to 10 minutes. We're inbound going to go help somebody. So, and we took pride in what we did. So obviously, a lot of the rescues that we had, you could have patient transfers from some of the native villages, remote villages. But a lot of times we had some pretty hairy rescues. And
I can imagine.
Yeah. I mean, you can get in trouble real quick. So this is a great topic. I mean, those that go fishing with me or hunting with me down here, they're like, gosh, what don't you have in that bag? I'm like, dude, I've spent a career picking people up, paying the dumb tax. And it ain't going to be me. I'm not going to get evac'd, so only takes one time, to your point, Joseph, like getting scared and not being prepared, and going like, okay, that's never going to happen again. Cause things can go south real quick.
Well, thank you for your service, by the way.
Yep.
Yeah.
It sounds like having to be where you can get off the ground in 5 to 10 minutes. I know you guys had to do a ton of planning and probably a lot of
maintenance,
lot of prep and just being ready to roll like that. So that's definitely the reason why I wanted to have you on and kind of talk through this. And it pays to to do the planning. You mentioned that this was happening in Alaska. Why were people getting into trouble? What was the most common? You know, like my experience with outdoor emergencies has been a venomous snake bite and falling out of a tree stand. Probably weren't dealing with that too much in Alaska. What really gets people in trouble the most often?
That's a great question. A variety of things. I mean, outside of, and I got some stories that we'll go through that to kind of prove some very important lessons. But one of the first things is mechanical failures. Whether you're riding we call them snow machines. You guys might know them as snowmobiles. You know, that's how you kind of get around. Or maybe you're flying a Super Cub. So mechanical issues, or your boat breaks down, capsizes. Now you're all wet. Now what do you do? So mechanical. I mean, one of the first things you could do is, like, every time I buy a boat, I'm just conditioned. It's like I'm going offshore. And I go to the mechanic and I go, okay, I need my OSHIT kit, you know, and that's my kit. Like, what can go wrong with this boat? What can go wrong with this motor? And I want to be able to fix it while I'm out there. I'm not going to get caught out there, you know, because I don't have, you know, a bolt or, you know, something that I need to fix things, you know? So, and if you talk to mechanics, you simply just go, hey, what do you see fail on this motor all the time? We'd go 100 miles down the Yukon River for our moose hunts, you know. Wow. So we're pre-positioning fuel, you know, weeks prior, and we're planning all that out. And then you have your OSHOOT kit that I could rebuild that motor if I need to, if something fails, because, you know, and never underestimate the importance of, you know, 100 mile an hour tape or duct tape, safety wire, zip ties. You know, you do what you need to do to get home. So mechanical failures, that's a big deal. So know your machine, know how to work on it if it breaks, whether it's a side-by-side or a four-wheeler down here, you need to be able to repair that thing. You know, you can't, if you're 100 miles into the woods and you're deer hunting and your side-by-side breaks down, you may not have a signal. No one's going to come out and replace it if you just take it to Polaris. You know, sit down and talk to the mechanic and have them take you through, like, hey, what breaks on these things? What are some things that you see going wrong? Because they see them all the time. So they're a great wealth of information, and it's free.
Yeah.
You know, and you buy the parts right there, or buy them off
Amazon.
Some
redundancy in your mechanical systems is what I'm really hearing you say. And that's a good, you know, we talk about it a good bit of just even doing some prophylactic maintenance. Like if you're dealing with outboard engines, not a bad idea to just go ahead and replace that water pump impeller every year. You know, it's going to fail at some point. Why let it fail? It's a cheap fix. Like, don't get stranded over something dumb like that. You sling a hub, you can have an extra prop in the boat, you know. That's a great tip on the mechanical side. What else? What else was getting people in trouble out there? Is it freak stuff? I mean, I think Alaska, I'm like, oh man, the grizzlies are everywhere. You know, was that really what was bringing a lot of the calls, or is it more just dumb stuff that could have been prevented?
A lot of dumb stuff. I mean, you'd be surprised how many times people would go, they go out in the wilderness. I mean, you can get, you know, the majority of Alaska is not privately owned. Only 9% of the state is actually privately owned. The rest is native or state land, which you go hunt and you just go to the end of a road and keep going. I mean, you can get to a lot of the hunting areas. So, I mean, the vastness is almost unfathomable unless you've seen it with your own two eyes. So, I mean, you just get really, really remote. But signaling devices, I mean, there's no, you know, we're flying around trying to find you a lot of times under night vision goggles. And even at a couple hundred feet off the deck, I mean, it's hard to pick you out. And it's amazing. It was amazing to me how many times I'm out there looking for somebody, a lost snow machiner, and all they have is a lighter as a signaling device. You know, and it's like you buy one of those little pointer lasers from, you know, a gas station and put in your bag or flares or something to be able to at least say, hey, here I am. You know, if we're down here in the, you know, a mirror, you know, signaling mirror. Seems cheesy. It works. I can see you. The glint from a mirror is very visible, you know, several thousand feet in the air. So it's going to give you a lot better chance to get rescued.
Nick here spends a lot of time in the Mobile Tensaw Delta. It's what, about 200,000 acres or so, Nick?
Yeah. All total is, yeah, as far as everything that's not developed. Yeah. You get about 100,000 acres of state land and then another 100,000 that's privately owned wetlands. Yeah.
Do you have a signaling device, Nick?
You know, so my dad told me years ago, I have an all my life jacket. I have a space blanket and I have a lighter because he put it very poetically. He said, if something happens to me and I'm stuck out in this swamp, he said, I may die, but it won't be because they couldn't see me, because I'm going to set the whole island on fire. They're going to know right where I'm at.
That's fair.
I like it. What about communication, Wes? I mean, you mentioned, you know, the signaling side up there, very remote. I mean, seems like a lot of this could be solved, especially nowadays with
InReaches.
Yeah, and Garmin InReach and SpotX.
SpotX.
And all the various communication devices. I mean, is that another thing you saw people overlooking, that, you know, it's just a matter of spending some money and getting it?
Yeah, spending money and getting it. The InReach and the Spot devices work really well. I love the InReach is just because it's automatic. You know, you kind of set it to where it's like leaving a breadcrumb trail for you. So, you know, mama at home is watching and can pull up the app and see exactly where you are. And that just helps if they got to send a search party out. Because remember, if you got like a civilian provider and they launch, I mean, it's no different than, I mean, someone's got to pay for that flight time. I mean, they're not just burning holes in the sky. You know, if you are out in the middle of 200,000 acres, you know, and they got to deploy a rescue team, I mean, they're going to bill you. So you need to make sure that you can make that as expeditious as possible, just from a financial standpoint, but more importantly, just so that you're found. I bought an Iridium phone. Mm-hmm. I've had it for years. I really don't go a whole lot of places without that. If I go offshore, it's always on me. It's easy. It's about that big. I get a card. You can buy a satellite card, and I really only use it to check in. You can send text from it. I can call, but that's a game changer. And it was a worthwhile investment. For it's about a $2,000 investment when it's all said and done. And the plans are a little expensive, but you can get plans where it's like use it. If you're in trouble, you really just need to send your position, and it's got an SOS button on it that will bounce your SOS to your emergency contacts. You know, it'll give your GPS position, everything. So if you are serious about getting remote, that's certainly, I mean, when Hurricane Michael came, right? Mm-hmm. So outside of being outdoor, I mean, Hurricane Michael came, cell phones went down. Well, I had my Iridium phone. We called it Zombie Land. We go over to help out some folks over in Panama City. And I mean, I had like people coming to me being like, yeah, you guys want to use it? Go ahead, use it. It's here to use. And I was letting people use the Iridium phone, just calling their loved ones saying, hey, I'm okay.
Yeah.
I'll call you when we get up. Yeah. And we're okay. So, but yeah, those are great devices. Not a lot of people, you know, it's cheap insurance. It's a great Christmas gift to give somebody who's an outdoorsman, because it's just, but you do need to learn them too. You got to know how they work. You know, if the first time you're using a sat phone or an InReach is the time where you need it, you probably already screwed up. So knowing your equipment and being able to know how they work is important too. Cause I've seen that happen also.
Yep. That's a great point. I actually got one for Christmas last year and I like it a lot.
Yeah.
The InReach, that is. So it kind of seems like we're going down the path here. We're talking about, you know, being prepared for an emergency, particularly in a remote area. I would think a big part of that is, like Joe mentioned, having a plan. You know, what exactly is an outdoor emergency action plan?
Well, this kind of ties into, so you had said, Butch, you said a lighter, right? Okay. I got a story. This is one of our rescues. This was actually the one that we were interviewed on the Today Show and was in the Reader's Digest, picked it up and wrote a story about it. And then later became an episode in a show on Discovery called I Shouldn't Be Alive. But they screwed it all up.
Getting the real story today.
Yeah, they did. They missed the key parts. And it's going to come down to the emergency plan, right? So It was a doctor out of Oklahoma City and his father. He was a little bit older. They've been talking about this trip going up to to an area up in Alaska called Gates of the Arctic National Forest, which is just north of Bettles, Alaska. And if you look on the map, it literally is up in the middle of nowhere. But it is one of the most beautiful, picturesque places on earth. If you ever take a trip up there, charter a flight, have someone fly you up there and look at it. I mean, it is absolutely breathtaking. And they wanted to go up there and do a rafting trip. So they had coordinated with an outfitter out of Bettles called Coyote Air. They're great. And so they got all their gear together. They planned this trip for like 2 years, right? Bought their tickets, went up there. It was in the spring and landed in Bettles. And the transporter, we call them transporters, where their job is to take you off grid and just land on a strip and drop you off. And then, you know, maybe they pick you up at a predetermined date. That's it. They're just a ride. And so these guys' plan was to get dropped off on the North Fork of the Koyukuk River. And they were going to float down on a 5-day float. And then they were going to come, they were going to pull out in Bettles, Alaska. Well, the key thing that they did before they went out was they filed a float plan. So they stopped in at the ranger station there in Bettles and they filed a float plan, which just said, we're getting dropped off here. This is our route that we're going to go and we'll be back here. And that was pretty simple, right? The mission came in and the ranger called us and I was piloting command that night. His name is Ranger Seth McMillan, and Ranger McMillan filed a medevac request. And all I had was, the only information I had was two patients, no food, no water for 5 days. And then I had a grid coordinate. I just had a lat long. So my planning was literally mapping it and looking and seeing, and I'm like, okay, that's 250 miles from here, straight north. And I said, well, let's go. We're going to plan a route and try to get as much as we can on the way there. So we just took off and found a heading and we just kept flying. And we came up on the, I'm looking at the map at this time, you know, I had a little handheld, but we didn't have glass cockpits or anything. We were like real pilots, you know, actually having to fly the aircraft, you know, didn't fly itself. And we had to navigate too. So I'm looking at my map and I go, I think this is like, this grid corn is taking me right to the middle of the river. And we're getting closer. And I look down, I think I see some people on this sandbar. And it's literally a sandbar right in the middle of the river. And I see someone, you know, signal us down. So I come down, I land. Ranger McMillan comes over, gets up on the headset. I said, what's up, bud? What's your name? He's like, this is Ranger McMillan. I said, oh, dude, nice to meet you. You know, I'm Captain Madden. We're here to help. What's going on? And he had a map and he said, Coyote Air, when they came up late, he's out doing training in the middle with his Ranger underlings out there, you know, teaching them some survival stuff. And he said, yeah, father, son, they went out. They were overdue on their float plan. So I called Coyote Air and said, hey, you need to go check on your clients that got dropped off that are overdue. And so Coyote Air flew up the valley where they had dropped them off and finally saw somebody wave him down. And they dropped a VHF radio down to him on the air-to-air CTAF freak. And he got on and he just said, no food, no water. Dad's hurt. Please send help. That was it. That was the only information we had. So I gave the map to him. He pointed, I said, where's the sun? And he said, he's looking at the map and he goes, right here. And I said, okay, so clear up left and right, go ahead, hop on in. I had the ranger get on. We picked up, we flew up the river about 50 miles, maybe a little less, and flew right to the GPS point. And I see the kid. So I say kid, he was like a, you know, 42-year-old man. Landed, he came and got on the bird. Our medic went out and helped him, assessed for injuries. He was fine, certainly tired and hungry and everything else. Got him on the bird, put him up on ICS, said, where's dad? And he looked at the map and he said, right there. He pointed out the map and he goes, that's where dad is right there. And it was in a bend. It was a sharp bend in the river. So I said, okay, clear up left and right. Here we go. We picked up, start taking off. And I look down and I go, there's a big bear right there. And there was this big grizzly bear, right, not 20 yards away from where I picked him up. He said, yeah, that guy's been, that bear's been hunting me for the past 3 days.
Oh no!
I've been evaded him. He's like, I haven't slept in 3 days. Wow. He's been terrorizing me. And you know, and then as we're flying up, he starts kind of sort of telling the story, but I'll save that for later. But then we get up, I fly to that bend, I look out and I see a fire, I see smoke. And so we came in, landed on the bank of the river, medic gets out, grabs the patient. He had a laceration across his forehead, got him on the bird, and we picked up and head back to Bettles. Well, the story was, when they got dropped off and they got ready for this amazing, you know, this trip that they'd been dreaming of and planning for, they had a catamaran and they took off down the river. Well, in the spring in Alaska, you have runoff and the river's surging really, really hard. It was a little early. It was like 1st of June, which is still pretty early in Alaska. Things are still, you know, you got melt off still happening. And yeah, they're still, they thought, you know, June seems hot. June is summer in Oklahoma. You know, it's 100 degrees in June. Well, in Alaska, it's not necessarily the case. And they went around the first bend. There was a fork in the river. They could have went left, could have went right. They decided to go right for whatever reason. And they came around, there was an ice shelf over the river. So they said, shoot, there's an ice shelf. This is their first bend, by the way. Okay. They just put the boat in the water. So they're trying to paddle over to the side of the river and they can't get over. They're paddling as hard as they can. The river's raging so much. They're heading towards this ice shelf. They hit that ice shelf and their catamaran flipped into the water. So them, all their gear, their food, everything they had went in the drink and they bounced underneath the ice. And that stretch was about, I'd say like 40 yards. And then they'd pop out. And then they had another ice shelf that they bounced under. Dad hit his forehead on, split his head open. And then once they got out of that, they swam. That was about 100 yards that they went under. And then they swam to shore. And that was the point where, you know, they got out. They literally had waders on, no boots. They didn't even have their boots on because they were in the boat. They didn't think they needed their boots. So it was just neoprene waders. But the son had two things on his person. That was all he had. He had his life preserver on. And he had two things on his person. One was a picture of his family. The other thing was a survival lighter. It's a little Cabela's survival lighter with the top on it. It's waterproof. It's a butane lighter. And he said, single hand, he's like, that's what saved our lives by far. So dad was not doing good. They were both hypothermic. He made a fire and made a lean-to for his dad, laid him down, you know, got the bleeding under control a little bit. And, you know, and he was advising his dad at night, it got cold. So he was taking the river rocks and putting them under to keep his core body temperature warm enough. Cause it got below freezing at night. And so about a day of that, the son's sitting there thinking like, well, there isn't anybody coming to help.
Right. I got to go find somebody.
I got to do something. So he's like, I'm just going to start heading down river. And I'm going to try to walk back to Bettles. It was about a 50 mile hike, you know, and he's like, I can't wait here. So he just kept going. And he got to a point, he hiked for a couple of days, and that's when the bear picked up and started chasing it, you know, started kind of tracking him. And he got to a point where there was a fork in the river, and there was no way of getting across there. And he was stuck. And so he was just kind of stuck there, fending off this bear, fending off the mosquitoes. They had mud all over their face. And he said, be honest with you, he said, I stopped thinking about the bears after day three because the mosquitoes were so horrendous. I couldn't breathe. They were literally eating me alive. And so they had mud all over their face, keeping the mosquitoes off. And
wow.
Yeah. So what was a big like rescue, really, there are two things that he did that were really smart. Number one, he had a survival lighter on him, on his person. So even if he did go in the drink, he had it on him. He had that in his life preserver. And he filed a float plan. If he hadn't done one of those two things, they wouldn't be with us today. And even though it was the entire, and there's more to the story a little bit, but even though it was a lot of logistics to get there, the ranger knew how to read a map and was competent. He was a former infantryman in the Army, ironically enough. The guys, you know, they filed that float plan and they knew, you know, everyone kind of played their part, so to speak. It was one of the easiest missions I had been on because everyone was competent along the chain. So
my palms are sweating right now, freaking out.
Yeah, for real. Wes, you telling that story, so it reminds me of some research I did on my own a few years back. So I hunt a lot of public land. We got a lot of rednecks with rifles here in Alabama. And I made the decision a couple years ago to quit climbing trees when I deer hunt. And I had a lot of people tell me, they're like, oh man, there's no way in the world I would hunt public land and just sit on the ground because some yahoo's going to shoot you. And most states actually have, as part of the eligibility that they get for their Pittman Robertson funding, they have to report hunter accidents. And the two big accidents that they report are shootings and falls, like tree stand mm-hmm. accidents. And when you crunch the numbers on it, you were something like 25 to 50 times more likely, depending on the state, to either fall out of your tree stand, or if you're going to get shot, like everybody is worried. The big thing on people's mind is like, man, what if somebody thinks I'm a deer and they shoot me? Well, you're way more likely to shoot yourself or get shot by your buddy back at truck or when you're having a whiskey drink at camp after a hunt. Like the odds, like as far as people getting shot by a stranger, that's such a disproportionately high worry in people's mind that people plan for, like, oh, I'm a climb, so I'm above line of sight if they're shooting a rifle. And realistically, like if you sit on the ground and you wear your hunter's orange, you're statistically more safe. So yeah. Like talking about your story, like people worry about like, man, what if I'm in Alaska and a bear gets after me? And your story, like the real issue was something as mundane as just ice, you know, just mm-hmm. an ice shelf. It's not something getting you wet. Think about. Yeah. Yeah. Getting wet, like, or mosquitoes, you know, like there's threats that people don't think about in your experience. What are some misconceptions people have? Like, are there risks that you think people over prepare for? And then maybe some that in your experience that people aren't planning for, but happen all the time, or just what are some other misconceptions about what an actual emergency looks like?
Well, I think some of the obvious things that people don't think about are wet feet. I mean, it can be you can get hypothermia in, you know, 60 degree weather, you know, I mean, you know, so waterproofing your feet, you know, having a good beanie to put on. I mean, it gets cold. And sometimes, you know, for those of you that, if you've hunted and you have to spend the night, you know, like you're getting out there in the morning, it's a little chilly, you're hunting all day and it's, and, you know, it heats up and then you got to, you know, God forbid, you got to spend the night, you know, like that survival blanket takes up nothing in your pack. But you sure as heck be glad that you got it. If you have to spend the night out there and, you know, accidental discharges are a thing. We had a lot of those all the time. You'd have a lot of, you know, so gun safety, don't fire, you know, I mean, just, I think just simple marksmanship protocols, but I mean, you're out there, if you're getting shot by somebody, it's usually not they're eyeballing you and thinking you're a deer as much as it is, like you said, accidentally shooting yourself. So muzzle awareness. I can't tell you, we had a lot of those, you know, and, you know, don't, you know, everyone's got, you know, I'm certainly not a gun. There's guys that are really good at, gun experts. I mean, I don't put a round in the chamber unless I'm ready to shoot, you know, I mean, it's just,
I think the thing that I heard you say, you know, listening to your story about the guys that got into trouble on the river. And when I think back to the times that I've gotten into trouble, the main thing is to me is that you just, it happens so fast. I think everybody thinks
for sure
that they're going to have time to react, and you don't. I mean, it's already over with and has happened, and then you're going, oh crap.
Well, and you could be injured trying to figure it out as well.
Yeah, most of the time you are, you know, or somebody in your party is. I mean, like in my two experiences with it, one was me falling out of a tree stand, and the other was my 4-year-old son being bitten by a water moccasin. Yeah. Like, one scenario, I'm trying to figure out what to do when I've got bad internal injuries and a bunch of broken bones. The other scenario is I'm freaking out because I'm worried about my son and I'm trying to figure out what to do. And thankfully, you know, I had, like, what we do on my place is we have a shared note that everybody's got on the iPhone where, you know, if somebody comes out to my place, a guest, and they're hunting with me, I'm like, here, make you a part of this note. And here's the closest emergency rooms to this, to where we're hunting here, you know, because what if the guy who's got the plan in his head is the one who's incapacitated? Like, I feel like having everybody be somewhat prepared to at least get out of the woods and be able to deal with this stuff is important. So the hardest part about creating a plan is trying to think about all the various scenarios that could happen that you're planning for. We've talked about really a lot of the stuff that should be in that plan, being able to have some signaling devices, some communication devices, thinking about what's the worst case scenario and how could I deal with that? Okay, if I get wet, do I have a way to make a fire and get warm? What do you think people should really incorporate elements wise into their emergency action plan? Like, what's going to get them, what preparation is going to help them solve the vast majority of the problems that might arise?
Well, I think one of the simplest things you do is tell somebody where you're going and when you're planning on returning. I mean, whether it's your wife or if you know, and I get it, man, there's a beauty to hunting on your own. I've done it. It's fun, but it does increase the danger. But I mean, certainly tell them, you know, I would sit down with my wife and say, I'm going to this stand, I'm going to be here. I'm going to be hunting. Here's the grid corners for where I'm at. I will, you know, I'll call you or text you at, you know, by this time. And if not, you know, call a buddy, he knows where the stand is, have him come out and check on me. So just a simple, like, you know, it's like the float plan, right?
Yep.
It doesn't have to be complicated. You know, if I'm hunting, like Nick's saying, like in the middle of 200,000 acres, I mean, I want my wife to know where the grid coordinates of where I'm going to be hunting, where I'm going to be setting up. Because if you're outside of cell service, if you don't have any signaling device, if you haven't invested in that spot or that the Garmin InReach or the sat phone or whatever, I mean, at least somebody knows where to go to start finding you. That's the most frustrating thing from a rescue guy, is just like, we got nothing to work from because they didn't tell their wife where they were going. We're just kind of sort of, and what you do is you do a grid pattern, and it takes forever. And all that time you're out there suffering. We want to find you. You're hurt or injured or really cold. You know, we just want to find you. You made it so hard because you just didn't communicate where it is you're going and what your plan is. And so that's the first thing. But fire, water, food, you know, high energy food that can sustain you for a while. You know, water, getting water. I think a lot of times people underestimate the importance of water. If you gotta spend a little time, you know, unplanned time, I always overpack water. That's just one thing. I'm like, I never want to like go light on water. And if I do run out of water, I got some sort of water filtering device that I can get water. Certainly important. But I think like sitting down and just walk through what could go wrong, you know, and do I have enough in my pack? You don't need to weight yourself. You don't need to be taking everything but the kitchen sink out with you, but just enough. And I think first aid, you know, admittedly, when you asked me to come on, I'm like, oh man, I'm not a medic. I don't, you know, I had medics that were, you know, paramedically trained and really, really good. But you should have a basic lifesaver type course that you go. I mean, if you're going to be an outdoorsman, you need to be able to know how to treat a gunshot wound or
build a fire. I mean, something as simple as that, honestly.
Yeah, all the basics, man. I mean, it's like you may never have to use it, but you sure are glad you got that training if you do need to use it. And I don't know if you guys know of resources out there or clinics or camps or who puts that on, but I mean, you know, it's worth it. It's, you know, and teach your kids. That's the other thing too, is teach your kids. I got an 18-year-old, he's starting to go off on his own, do adventures, you know, and, you know, it's just, I'm anxious, not because I'm worried about him taking risks. I'm anxious that I haven't taught him enough, you know, and really spent the time to make sure that, you know, he can handle those situations. So,
well, you know, like, you know, going back to what you're saying, I've got a buddy, a good friend of mine, who he's a nurse and he spent a lot of time in emergency rooms and in ICUs. And he's been hunting with me on our place. And he was up there with me a couple of years ago and we were going around. I was kind of telling him the story about Mac, my 4-year-old that was bitten by the water moccasin and what all that entailed and everything. And he said, man, you know, you need a bleed kit like out here, you know, like if you're 45 minutes from an emergency room, if you're up here working on the tractor and something happens and, you know,
chainsaw
or you get shot. If you get a bleeder, like you're going to have to deal with that out here. And, you know, I was like, yeah, I guess that's true. I hadn't thought about that. I can't just necessarily count on, you know, being able to get to an emergency room in time. And, you know, thinking, you know, that I had a guy up at my place. He was running an excavator and a dozer, de-stumping an area that we're going to plant. And he's pushing up a big stump pile. And he sent me a video from the inside of the excavator. And there must have been 1,000 yellow jackets just nailing his windshield, you know. And he's like, and I'm thinking about it going, I'm out here running around on a tractor without a cab on it. That could be me. I just go over to move a stump pile, you know, and then all of a sudden here we are stirred up in a yellow jacket nest. It's not always the big bad grizzly bear. Yep. That,
or the chainsaw cutting your leg off.
Right? No, sometimes it's something simple. And, you know, I was talking to my wife, like, man, I guess we need a little syringe of Epi out here. Thankfully, she's a medical professional, you know, and, you know, some stuff like that. And I think what I've learned about it is that you got to take ownership of it. Like, you can't just expect that somebody's going to be able to save you. But like you said, there are people who are ready to take action on something like this. And there are people that are ready for this. And as long as you got a way to get in touch with them and deal with what's going on until they get to you, you're going to be ready for everything that can be prevented, I would think.
Well, I think what you said there, your wife's a medical professional. Find somebody who has like emergency medical training and have them put your first aid kit together.
Yeah.
You know, because if you just use the ones, you know, I went on Amazon, I bought a first aid kit. Like, you know, it's got the, you know, you have like 5 Band-Aids.
Right.
And a couple, you know, it's
not
like,
going to have a tourniquet in it. It's not going to have blood clotting gauze in it. Yeah.
Sutures.
You know, get a bunch of those blood clot patches are great. You know, one-handed tourniquets. Those, that's standard issue. I actually know the medic who he's an 18 Delta. He's really cool. I was in Afghanistan. He's like, hey, man, yeah, I patented this one-handed tourniquet and he ended up selling it to the military. And I think he's probably retired now on whatever money he made from all that. It was just kind of cool because he was like showing me how it worked and everything. I was like, that's awesome. Then later now it's like standard issue. So
that's very cool.
Get your arm snatched off in a PTO on a tractor. You're not going to be able to put a tourniquet on with it. You're going to need the one-handed.
Yeah, same thing with building fires. Like I know that got really trendy for a little bit. People have like the little fire strikers and stuff like that. And you look at them and you're like, man, how are you going to hold a flint in one hand and a steel in the other hand if you done broke your arm, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, we do like, I would do like Vaseline and cotton balls and put it in a little, you know, in a little Ziploc bag or something, throw it in there. It takes, you just forget it's in there, but it's like, oh, geez, if I need to start a fire, I mean, I got a fire's done. No matter if it's pouring rain or I'm in a wet condition, I can still get warm. And yeah, I think you got to geek out on a little bit, man, because it's, you know, but I think the best part is like go go out, and I do it with my kids, like just go out and like, hey, let's go start fires a couple different ways, you know? And I did you go to these like military schools and they have this down pilot training outside of Eielson Air Force Base. And you got to do it when the temperature is minus 20 or lower. And the idea, it's called Cool School, Arctic survival training. And so the setup is that you're a down pilot. You're in the middle of the Alaskan wilderness. It's cold and you got to survive. So you go out there with like no food or water and just like the clothes you got, a little bit of 550 cord and some parachute material. And you get one match and a survival knife, you know, and you spend all week, you know, learning how to build a snow shelter, how to keep yourself warm, how to make your own water. And you know, it's like the pass or fail grade is you gotta be able to make a fire, with that one match, you know, and it's, anyways, it's a lot of it's set up, right? You gotta get your kindling all pulled together and make it count. You know what I mean? And I kind of took the Alaska approach where you pour a bunch of diesel on some wet wood and then get a, you know, some sort of, it's not exactly, you know, you don't have those things available when you're out in the middle of nowhere. So you do need to get a little bit primitive. I'm not saying you need to be rubbing sticks together to make, but you know, we've got plenty of technology to be able to, you know, start a fire like that. And it doesn't take up a lot of space or weight. So
be resourceful, have a plan. You know, what my emergency action plan might look like on a couple hundred acres in central Alabama. That's not, you know, it's more remote than Santa Rosa mm-hmm. Beach, Florida, but it's not remote as Alaska by any means. But what my EAP might look like would be, may be completely different than what your EAP might look like if you're heading offshore in the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you got to think about what are those scenarios that you might come and encounter. But ultimately, it sounds like the biggest thing is being able to handle basic first aid, basic food, water, shelter until you can get rescued. And if you're going to get rescued, you got to have a way to get in touch with people.
Yep.
You got to have a way to signal them. You got to have a way to communicate.
Yeah, I mentioned it earlier, but safety wire. So in that Cool School, when everyone talked about how you just starved to death, right? And it's, I mean, you really don't have any food and you're out there like eating these like little berries and stuff. I'm like, oh, this ain't gonna work for me. So I made snares with that safety wire. I was eating like four squirrels a day. If I catch a rabbit here and there. And then you boil it to get all the nutrients, right? So I'm eating all of it, right? And I mean, I was like, this ain't that bad, you know? And then some of my classmates are like, oh, I can't eat that. I'm like, oh, more for me, I guess. Right. I don't know. I mean, but it gave you confidence that like, but I'm telling you, because of that, I carry safety wire. Safety wire is like, it weighs nothing. It just put a couple, you know, get a spool in there. I'll take 100 mile an hour tape, duct tape, and wrap it around my pack. You know, we use frame packs to carry out the meat and stuff. And I'd wrap that on there. So I'm not carrying around like a thing of duct tape, but I got it on me just in case you never know. You know, you could suture up a large cut or something with duct tape. I mean, you can use it for anything. So
yeah, great point.
Well, Wes, it's kind of a funny story on how you got to be on this show doing this interview with us, because your wife actually works out at the same gym as me. And we were talking about something completely different. We were talking about your guys' farm. You know, you guys raise Wagyu cattle. And I was all interested in that, learning about that. And I was reading about your farm and found out you had this medevac experience. I was like, man, Wes is going to be the perfect guy to talk about this because he's going to be able to share experience with this and then really be able to talk about the importance of having the plan. And I bet you saw some wild stuff up there in Alaska and really saw the importance of people that did well because they probably had a plan. And then I'm sure you saw some sad stories too, where folks that didn't have a plan didn't do so great.
That is the truth. It didn't take much to be safe is the good news, you know, and a little bit of forethought and communication and, you know, it shouldn't keep you from enjoying the outdoors. You know, that's a great thing with technology. I mean, we're able to really enjoy the outdoors and do it safely. And, you know, I just appreciate you having me on the show. My wife's a beast, as you know, she's an animal in that gym, man. I appreciate the invite, and I'm really, I look forward to future shows.
Yeah. Yeah. We're looking forward to talking Wagyu with you soon. I got to learn how a guy from Alaska gets into Wagyu, but we'll save that for the next show, man.
It's a good story
today,
as usual.
All right, guys, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back with a little bit more about emergency action planning. This week's show is brought to you by Farm Credit of Northwest Florida. Farm Credit of Northwest Florida has over a century of experience providing financing for people who live, work, or play in the country. Farm Credit is here to help you make your dream of country living a reality. Their unique cooperative structure allows them to return some of their profits back to their borrowers. This patronage distribution effectively lowers a borrower's rate. To get started with your first or next land purchase, give them a call at 855-GO-RURAL or visit them at www.gorural.net. Mallard Bay Outdoors. MallardBay.com is the Airbnb-style marketplace for discovering and booking your next guided hunting and fishing adventures. The Mallard Bay platform was built by sportsmen for sportsmen. Their mission is to help expand access to affordable and successful hunting by connecting you with verified outfitters across the United States. You can browse trips and prices by state or species, select the dates you'd like to go, message outfitters, and secure your dates all from one platform. MallardBay.com. Not sure where you want to go yet? Reach out on Instagram or Facebook and they can help you find your dream hunt. Texas Hunter. Since 1954, Texas Hunter Products has produced the best engineered and finest quality feeders and hunting blinds in the industry. The Texas Hunter brand has become synonymous with quality and durability. By sticking to premium standards, the company delivers tough, long-lasting products that meet the real-life needs of anglers and hunters across America. Their fish feeders, deer feeders, hunting blinds, and outdoor accessories are among the highest rated in the industry. You can trust that your purchase from Texas Hunter Products will meet your needs for generations to come. To learn more, visit TexasHunter.com. All right, guys, we're back. And this next segment is something that we recorded on a different day a little while back, and we didn't really know how we were going to use it. We just knew this was interesting information that's good for everybody to know that might be spending some time in remote areas. We're all potentially susceptible to having an emergency and needing to get out. You know, like Wes's experience being a medevac pilot, you know, Nick, he was doing this day in and day out. I hope nobody ever needs this, but you know, you saw somebody have to get, you know, taken out, and you found out some interesting information about this.
Yeah, for sure. The area where I'm at, with my, you know, my wife and my little daughter, we're pretty rural. We spent a lot of times in places where really realistically that would be how you got out, was with life flight. And it was interesting to me to find out that a lot of times that would be something that wouldn't be covered under the insurance that I already have. For this next segment, we're going to go ahead and we're going to talk about the information that you need to know so that if you ever need life flight, it is covered. And to do that today, we're here talking with Sarah Gordon with AirMed Care Network. Sarah, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you all for having me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we had this was kind of a pertinent topic because it was just last week I was at the boat ramp here by my house and they had the life flight helicopter in the launch. So it kind of got on my mind and figured that this would be a good conversation to have to share with our listeners. Kind of give us in a nutshell, let our listeners know kind of what you guys do over at AirMed Care Network.
Sure. So we are an alliance of air ambulance providers. One side of our business provides the air medical service, the air medical transports. AirMed Care Network is a membership product that provides financial protection if you do need to use our services. We have 320 aircraft across 38 states. We are the largest membership product in the country as it pertains to air medical flights. So if you were to be flown by any of our providers, AirMed Care Network membership ensures that you have no out-of-pocket expense associated with that transport.
So Sarah, you know, when Nick brought you guys to my attention, I was really surprised to learn that, you know, like, you even exist. I mean, because when I think about something like a life flight, which Nick just witnessed happening, I would think something like that is going to be covered by health insurance. I've dealt with a couple of outdoor emergencies, one incident where I fell out of a tree stand, another incident where my son was actually bitten by a water moccasin. And the bills afterwards were pretty amazing in terms of what those two instances cost. And I was very fortunate that they didn't cost us a whole lot of money, but we never had to have a life flight. So does health insurance cover a life flight? Like, I mean, and I'm talking all health insurances, including, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, do they not cover life flights?
There are so many types of health insurance plans that it's difficult to speak to exactly what they're going to cover. I would definitely encourage people to look into their plans and what, you know, limitations that there may be on those plans as it pertains to air medical transport. There's a wide variety of levels of coverage So I would definitely, you know, advise people to get on and look at what your insurance plan does or does not do and question, you know, to what level they would cover. A lot of people don't know that until, you know, after the fact when they've already been transported and they're finding out, you know, that their insurance may have some gaps in that area.
Kind of piggybacking off that question. So like, I know a lot of times insurance will cover something up to a certain dollar amount. Can you tell us a little bit, what does it usually cost? I've always wondered that. I know an ambulance ride, I've seen the bill for that, and I can only assume that having a helicopter fly you somewhere is probably much more expensive. Is there a general ballpark as far as what that usually costs to get flown somewhere?
There are so many variables to how much it may cost due to the condition that the person could be in, the injury that they've suffered, the medications or procedures that are administered on board. There's really no way to give a specific cost, but if you think about ground, you know, and the difference between air and ground, the air bills are going to be significant. And so it's definitely something that you want to look into, something to research with your insurance plan. But, you know, in terms of a specific number, I couldn't speak to that just because there are so many different variables to it.
So Sarah, what about like some specifics? Like, I fell out of a tree when I was 19 and had to have a ambulance ride, probably needed a life flight, actually, considering where I was, but was able to get out with some help of some fellow hunters to a spot where we could get an ambulance too. Can you share any real life scenarios where someone was life flighted from an emergency like that, you know, in the outdoors? Nick and I both spend a lot of times in really remote locations in the grand scheme of things. Can you share some specific maybe case studies where somebody was or was not covered?
Absolutely. So we actually had a scenario where a young man, 17 years old, was at the Lake Eufaula in Oklahoma with his family, just enjoying their time, tubing, hanging out at the lake. He got a severe headache and his mother thought, you know, he just needs to lay down, take some Advil. So she gave him some Advil and he went to rest. But instead of getting better, his condition actually started to worsen and he began vomiting, lost feeling in the left side of his body. And so they called 911, obviously, and had an ambulance show up. The ambulance crew recognized that they thought he was actually having an aneurysm. Mm. And so, you know, in order to get a higher level of care, they called McAllister Regional Air Care, which is one of our providers, to meet them at the fire department. And so McAllister Regional Air Care showed up. They had to do some advanced stabilization procedures on board to get him stable enough to get to Tulsa where he had surgery. The young man had surgery. He's recovering really well, looking into going to, you know, the electrical trade. So he's progressing and he was actually able to meet that crew that he attributes to saving his life, later on and was really, really grateful. So that's just one scenario. There are many, many scenarios out there where, you know, we've seen things just in doing what we do, you know, people can get shot. They could fall out of a tree stand like you were mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in a rural area where, you know, getting to that higher level of care within the golden hour, within the first hour, is very beneficial to your recovery. And so that's where you may see an air ambulance come into play. If the ground ambulance can't get that person to the level of care that they need, you will see some utilization of an air ambulance at times, especially the more rural areas that you're in. And so there is an inherent risk that, you know, is associated with outdoors, whether it be hunting, fishing, ATV, anything like that. So it's really beneficial to look into something like this. You don't want to use it, but if you are to need it, it is very beneficial.
It's interesting to hear you give the example of the 17-year-old kid. I'm glad he's doing better. It's really scary. And it's something that when I think about an outdoor emergency, I think about something happening because I'm in the outdoors. Like we talked about, falling out of a tree stand or, you know, God forbid somebody gets shot or something like that. But I don't really think about just normal issues that can happen, you know, a heart attack, a stroke, an aneurysm that just happened to happen in a remote outdoor location, or, you know, in a location that's unable to get, you know, a typical ambulance to, or just not fast enough. And going back to what we were, you know, talking about, definitely investigating your health insurance and making sure that this is not something that's excluded, number one, or, you know, as Nick was saying, maybe it's covered up to a certain point. Definitely something that we all need to do. I know with all insurances, looking at your exclusions, looking at what is actually covered, because they give you a big old stack of paper and most people probably don't read all the way through. And this is one thing you can certainly investigate and make sure that you're covered, because of course you're going to use it, you know, but, well, I don't know. Not being covered after the fact would be very disappointing.
One thing to note too is that, you know, even with what we call good insurance, right, and having your healthcare in place, is most people still are going to have co-pays, co-insurances, and deductibles, and face the risk of a declination of claim. So that's really what membership, you know, pertains to, is those items that, you know, are cost sharing things that the person would have, even with good insurance. So that's what membership comes along and kind of plugs that gap to make sure that they're not going to have any out of pocket cost.
You know, one question I have is, do you have to be a member to be flown?
So one thing I think to note is that you do not have to be a member to be flown. We are going to respond, you know, to members and non-members alike, and get them the care that they need. The only difference between a member and a non-member is the potential bill. So a member has no out-of-pocket cost if flown by an AMCN provider. A non-member could face co-pays, co-insurances, deductibles, or declination of claim. So that's the only difference. We obviously don't, you know, check a membership before flying someone. It's after the fact that you find out, you know, what that cost sharing could look like or not.
Sarah, if folks are looking to join a Life Flight membership program like the one that you guys provide, what are some things that you recommend kind of considering, some options to weigh as you're shopping to join the network?
The one thing about membership and not being insurance is that we don't have reciprocity with other providers. The thing with our membership is that it does have to be one of our providers that responds. Again, we have 320 across 38 states, so we are the largest membership network in the United States. But you would want to check the coverage map and just make sure, you know, is where you're going covered? Do we have an asset there? We do have an interactive coverage map online that you can type in your zip code or location, and you're able to see whether or not we have coverage in that area. Keep in mind, too, as you're traveling, maybe not even for an outdoor purpose, but as you're traveling for vacation or whatever it may be, to kind of check where you're going, where you live, things of that nature. This is a low cost debt reduction product, but you know, you do want to make sure that the location you're going to would have that coverage.
Yeah, that's something I wouldn't have necessarily thought of, is that, you know, you would have to kind of check, you know, that kind of makes me, next time I see that Life Flight burden there, it kind of makes me want to do a little research on what that company is that's providing that air evac service. So.
Well, and Nick, you know, to that point, I've been lucky enough to get to go places and do some hunting. You know, last year I was in Montana hunting. This year I'm gonna go to Wyoming hunting. I mean, it is, you know, like I would think, just again, you know, I would think that health insurance would cover this. We're finding out it may or may not. Second, I would think that if I was part of a Life Flight membership, that I would just be covered, period. Sarah, that's a really good point that people need to investigate further, even within Life Flight membership. Make sure that in the places where they frequent and maybe are thinking about going to, that they're going to be covered as well. This is really interesting to me. I hope that nobody that's listening ever has to deal with it, never has to use it. But when you're talking about creating an emergency action plan, you need to be thinking about what you're going to do at every step of the process, so that when it happens, you fall to your level of training. You don't, you know, you will not figure this out when your adrenaline is pumping on high. And then you just want to make sure that you're covered after the fact. And when you're dealing with this after the dust has settled, you're not caught with any surprises Thanks for sharing this with us. If folks want to go find out more information about the Air Med Care Network, how can they go online, get more details, kind of look at your coverage network, everything that you've recommended today?
Sure. You can go to amcnrep.com, and that's really where they can find information about being able to contact their local sales manager as well.
All right, folks, we're going to be right back. Y'all take a minute and check out some of our sponsors. This week's show is brought to you by Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply. Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply offer numerous items to help get your project done right the first time. They carry a variety of different panel profiles and your choice of colors and gauges with all the matching trim and accessories. They also offer a full line of hardware items and post-frame building design. Their friendly and knowledgeable sales representatives are always willing to help answer any questions or concerns you may have. Contact them with any questions or to get a free estimate today. Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply, your metal roofing headquarters. Southern Seed and Feed. Do you want to provide better nutrients to your deer? If so, try Southern Buck Food Plot Blends. Your deer will love it. At Southern Seed and Feed, they specialize in making textured feed for horses, cattle, sheep, goats, hogs, chickens, small animals, and wildlife. Their products are proven irresistible, scientifically formulated to promote excellent herd health and hunter satisfaction. They supply products to various distributors throughout the South. So visit their website at southernseedfeed.com or call 662-726-2638 to find the dealer nearest you. Really cool to hear Wes's experience. You know, he got to see them all, you know, in that area. Like, he's seeing emergency after emergency after emergency after emergency. And if you're lucky, you never even have to deal with it. But, you know, maybe in one person's lifetime, you might see one or two emergencies. What was your big takeaway from it? Are you, you know, you going to do anything different when you go to your place, Butch, or when you're out on the water? I mean, it's not just about hunting, you know, it's
no doubt
kind of stuff. I mean, happens on the water too.
Absolutely does. A couple of key takeaways for me is I just don't ever want to be stuck anywhere and not be able to do anything about it.
It sucks.
Signaling devices, that's really cheap and easy. Communication devices, in the grand scheme of things, that's very cheap, small and easy. Filing, you know, a float plan or a trail plan or whatever you want to call it, that's very cheap and easy. You can do a couple things right and be set up pretty well and not have to, you know, break the bank. You know, I don't know. I think some of this stuff, I think, you know, like preppers and things like that, building bunkers and getting crazy prepared for everything. And you can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on things like that. But this is a very easy way to stay safe.
Yeah. There's a lot of companies that want to capitalize on fear too. And that's not,
no doubt.
You know, I don't think you have to break the bank to do this. I mean, you heard what Wes said. I mean, the biggest thing was really just communication. And yeah. I mean, I think signaling. Back to when I fell out of the tree stand, that was in 2004. You know, we really didn't have, I had a cell phone at that time, but it wasn't, I never even took it in the woods with me because it never worked
right
out there, you know? So right, it wasn't ubiquitous like it is now. And you know, there was no Spot X at that point. There was no Garmin InReach at that point.
Yeah. Satellite communication was incredibly expensive.
Yeah. Sat phones were
just about the time we got them on the boats. Right.
Man, it sucked. I laid out in the woods for 9 hours, you know, and the mosquitoes tearing me up and wondering, pretty much knowing that the only way anybody was going to find me was the next morning, you know, and I was kind of like going, all right, well, it's bow season. You know, do I have a way to fend off a coyote if it wants to mess with me? You know, like what could, and then being all banged up internally, you know, like I knew I was hurt internally, but I didn't know what was going on, you know, so you're kind of this little low level worry of like, am I going to make it through the night kind of deal? It sucks to be stuck.
Yeah.
That communication. And then, you know, like even when you've got communication, like when my son was bitten by the water moccasin, I had a phone, right? It was real easy, but I knew I was prepared for a venomous snake bite, and I knew I just needed to get him to antivenom. Like I needed to get him to antivenom. That was the number one thing. So I knew to call ahead to the closest emergency room. And it was a good thing I did, because they were a small rural emergency room. They did not have antivenom. So I had to go about 15 minutes further than there. I could have wasted some valuable time if I had just gone there thinking that surely somebody's going to be able to take care of my son. You know, my big takeaway for all this is you got to take ownership for preparation for an emergency. in whatever environment you're spending time in. If nobody's going to do this for you, don't wait until that moment. It happens so fast. And if you haven't prepared for it.
Well, that's why they're called accidents, right? You're not ready for it. I mean,
yeah,
I mean, called accidents. If you're not prepared at that time, it's going to be a much bigger deal. The accident's going to be a lot more impactful in your life.
You're not going to rise to the occasion. You're going to fall to whatever level of training you've got
at
that point.
Correct.
And get yourself a plan, even if it's just a simple one. Make sure you got a communication device, a signaling device, some basic first aid, and make sure people know where you are. If you do that, yeah, you're probably going to come out of it okay. If you could have come out of it okay.
Yeah. At least limit your opportunities to not turn out okay. I mean, even just simple stuff like me and Matt were at the camp a couple of weeks ago and it was just us, you know, I was going hunting, he was going hunting, and I had my truck keys in my pocket before we left the camp. And I was like, I'm gonna put these right here, Matt. You know, I'm just gonna let you know that the truck keys are right here. What, right, you know, what if I got stuck in the woods and got hurt or whatever, and he had no mode of transportation
or
whatsoever.
Shot yourself, you know,
who
you
knows?
What if so you just had had a heart attack, you know, I mean, and
he don't know where the truck keys are.
He needs to take you to the emergency room. How's he going to do it? You know,
yep.
Little things make big impacts when this kind of stuff happens.
No doubt.
Well, that's going to wrap it up for us this week.
Appreciate you joining us. We want to make it easy for you to listen. So here's a handy option for you. To get the podcast emailed to you each week, just text the word hunting to 773-770-4377. Again, just text the word hunting to 773-770-4377. You'll join our email list. And wherever you are listening to the podcast, go ahead, subscribe, rate, and review. Send us a written review. We'd love to hear from you. If you've got a show topic that you are interested in and like to see us cover, just email us at pros@landhunting.com. That's going to do it for us. Y'all stay safe out there. We'll talk to you next time.